Health Leader, and obviously your facilitator this afternoon. Thanks for joining us on a Sunday. Firstly, I would like to acknowledge that today at the Centre for Stories, we meet on the land of the Whadjuk Noongar people, the traditional owners and the custodians of this land. I wish to pay my respects to the elders past, present, and future, and want to further acknowledge the rich ongoing culture of storytelling of all Aboriginal people across Australia, as we meet here today at the Australian Short Story Festival to talk about stories and learn from those original stories.
I've done that so many times, sorry. I was being really careful too, sorry. And the timing was very poor.
Yeah. No, I just finished, hopefully with that ongoing presence in mind, we can continue to learn from those stories ourselves, as we reflect on our own and like others in the festival. Today I'm joined by Julia Prendergast and Jennifer Dunn. I'll just introduce us to begin with and then we can kind of get onto the combo. Julie is the Deputy Chair of the Australasian Association of Writing Programs. She's a lecturer in writing and literature at Swinburne University, Melbourne. Her novel, The Earth Does Not Get Fat, was published in 2018 by UWA Publishing. And it's probably helpful to note that many of the chapters in this book were kind of started off as short story and
various collections.
Recent short stories feature in the Australian Short Stories edition edited by Bruce Pascoe, number 66. Julie's short stories have been recognised and published in many places, including Lightship Anthology in the UK, River Train in the US, and in Australia in Text, The Review of Australian Fiction, Australian Book Review, and has also been a part of the Elizabeth Jolly and Josephine Ulrich Prizes. Julia's traditional research focuses...
Oh, don't worry about that, they won't care.
Oh, no! Okay, all right. Julia is an academic, and that's an important part of her practice.
Yeah.
And a part of that creative writing methodologies and that kind of stuff. But I'll cut off that.
Just sounds a bit long.
No, it's okay. I think these things are important to think about when talking about an author's creative works as well. And many of us are in academia, so mm-hmm. it kind of informs the way that we write and teach and all of those kinds of things. And Jennifer Dunn is a writer and editor who's and a translator.
Let us know.
Whose work has appeared in publications including Age, Sunday Paper, Australian Book Review, The Lifted Brow, Literary Hub, Killy Darlings, Big Issue, and Overland. So based in Melbourne.
Yeah. How'd you know?
I can laugh about that because I'm also from Melbourne. So. She's one of the Sydney Morning Herald's Young Novelists of the Year in both 2017 and 2018. Our Magic Hour, which was Jennifer's debut novel, was shortlisted for the 2014 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript and then went on to be published with Text Publishing, as is Pulse Points, the collection of short stories that came out last year. Jennifer has lectured and taught creative writing workshops and students of various ages in metropolitan and regional areas, which I think is important for the subject of your books as well, as the kind of crossing over between regional and metropolitan areas. And participated in writers' festivals across Australia. And just this week, Pulse Points won the Readings Prize for New Australian Fiction.
So
which, literally 2 days ago.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
So welcome to you both. So I have to say, when I first got asked to facilitate this panel, I was obviously excited because I wanted to meet these two lovely ladies. But I also was a little reticent of the title, Women's Voices. I guess for starters, where the hell do you begin with women's voices as like such a kind of large space? And what does women's voices even mean? And how does that include and exclude particular voices in and of itself? How could the three of us speak to something that is, of course, much larger and encompasses many more diverse identities than the ones that the three of us kind of might identify with here on this stage.
Mm.
But I do want to think of my own reading habits, and when I think about my own reading habits, I see that I do almost exclusively read books by contemporary female authors. Of course, there are classics thrown in there, and there will be like the odd guy every now and then. But
the token
man. Yeah. But unashamedly, I actually do celebrate and read like women authors quite a lot, and it does. I think I get a lot of joy and pleasure out of reading female authors because of the kind of shared experiences that you find within these texts.
Mm.
So here today, I don't want to think about the impossibilities of the topics of women voices, but to think about the possibilities instead and the opportunities that like thinking about a woman's voice could kind of bring us today, or the vital nature of talking about women's voices and talking about the complexities and the diversities of those voices and not being rigid in our understanding of what a woman's voice is.
Mm.
It's easy, of course, in a room full of supportive faces. And working in an industry, I think in the creative industries, there are lots of very powerful women and lots of women getting published and wonderful books. And so it's easy to forget that our current government is, of course, less than 20% women. And female members of that parliament are struggling to be kind of elevated and heard. Or that even in this Me Too movement, where across the world there has been this kind of conversation erupted, which has been really exciting and like confusing at times, but positive, I think, in moving forward, we still have to remember that women's voices are still routinely ignored and undervalued. I mean, just Christina Blasey Ford's participation in the Senate's approval in America is just like just one small example of the ways that women's voices are still kind of ignored, or if heard, not believed or undermined in various ways. So how might we think through, in an expansive, intersectional, feminist kind of way, what it is to be a woman and create strong women's voices, which I think both of your texts are contributing to this kind of experimenting with what a woman's voice is, or how might we define women's voices, or in the kind of contemporary moment. But before we talk about the texts in particular, and I want to shut up, sorry, this is a long, drawn-out introduction, but thinking through again that women's voices in particular, some women's voices are marginalised, of course, but women's voices more broadly are not, and there are so many important kind of historical figures that I think about that have really informed my understanding of Western literature or my contemporary reading practices, like even, of course, Virginia Woolf, but Jane Austen, Janet Frame, New Zealand author, or like sci-fi authors like Ursula K. Le Guin or Toni Morrison, Sylvia Plath, in terms of poetry, there are these authors that like continue to inform my reading experiences, my own writing practices. So I was just wondering, do you have a kind of historical consciousness of who are the voices that might have informed your writing practices? Or is there a kind of history of feminist literature that you can kind of think of? Or do you think of yourself as being a part of a kind of feminist history and literature?
So I don't really think of it in such formal terms of that, but
yeah.
Obviously I studied writing through university, have done 4 degrees in writing,
yeah.
So I can't not be shaped by all of those things.
Yeah.
I think as time goes on, I get more and more fascinated by, I was talking to a writing mate about this, about the, what it means to handle someone else's story material, what it means to edit people's material workshop, and what it means to share work and what the ethics around those things are. So I think part of that conversation is being aware in some respects of what my writing influences have been. But I don't list them off in that way. It's more just that I still resonate with particular voices, like Tilly Olson, who had such a tiny body of work,
but extraordinary work. So yeah, just works that I know in contemporary terms, Sophie Laguna's work and Josephine Rowe's work, you know,
yeah.
Just they kill it. I'm a fangirl, both of those. They kick it. So yeah, just being conscious. I'm definitely conscious of it, but not in terms of any kind of canon, just in terms of the voice.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same. It's not so much a formal thing as more kind of intuitive or impressionistic experience of having, like, I know that, you know, even when I was quite young and I read someone like Judy Blume writing about, you know, getting your first period.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not an experience that all women have. But for me, I think it was the first time I'd read about menstruation. And like I was, you know, 11 or something.
Yeah.
And of course, there are plenty of other examples of that out there now. I know that as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was that age, having access to something that felt kind of contemporary,
mm-hmm.
it there was such a profound relief in that it almost felt like I was doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least the fact that I had access to that. And that's one really small and quite a basic example.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, time and time again, I think probably what has informed my writing is when I see that in the work of a woman, in a female author's work, there are little glimpses of things that I go, oh yeah, you know, I've had that feeling, or I know what that is, I recognise that. Each time you see that as a developing practitioner, it's like a little act of permission that enables you to put that in your own work.
Yeah,
so true. Yeah. When we were talking about that yesterday too, like when you talk about like lived experience, and there's a chapter in this I wrote about the birth scene, which
mm-hmm.
you were discussing, and I've had a lot of women who've come to me and said who haven't had children, but who said, oh, that's what that's like. And I thought, how ridiculous, like, that when we don't talk about that stuff enough. I mean, not that you have to talk about birth every second, I'm not suggesting that,
I've been reading
heaps
about pregnancy and childbirth recently as research for a new novel.
Uh-huh.
And it's so, like, it just made me realise what a dearth of information is out there. And because I don't have children, and I've never written in detail about those experiences before. I have neither the experience nor the read experience, I guess, in the library of my brain.
Mm.
And so I've been actively trying to seek out these narratives, and it doesn't exist. Like, I could, you know, there are maybe 10 books that I've read that I go, oh yeah, that was really helpful to me as, you know, as not having had that experience to try and get a sense of what a profound psychic and physical shift that is.
So we were talking about this yesterday because, and let's just skip straight ahead to the birth scene, why don't we? But it is this incredibly visceral and quite violent scene, just because of the nature that the character finds themselves in. The circumstance of the birth itself is quite violent, and also the description itself is very visceral, and it's in the first person, and it's kind of getting like yelled at you in the text. It's an amazing experience to read. And there's only one other time I felt that similar kind of narration of a birth scene, and it's in Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts.
Mm.
And that was the first book that I had read where I had kind of experienced that similar kind of visceral and a very like real, it seemed to me, as someone who hasn't given birth to a child, seemed to be like a very real relation of the child, like of childbirth.
Mm.
That after, since having conversations with friends, I'm like, oh wow, you do shit yourself sometimes when you like give birth. Or there is these other experiences that happen that are often like glossed over or just not described in such kind of graphic ways.
Mm.
But yeah. Were you reading? This comes from your experience, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, I have children. Is that
what
I mean? Yeah, I have loads of kids. You don't want to know how many children I have. It's part of my lived experience. In fact, in the session this morning, we were talking about because my work is fractured, even though that's a novel. It's most of it's published as short stories. And someone said to me once about my family, "Don't worry, Julia. When your life is not so fractured, you'll be able to write a seamless kind of a proper novel.
Oh my gosh.
That's so awesome. It was sort of supposed to be a compliment. It was bizarre. Anyway,
yeah.
As an aside.
And also back towards this reading Judy Blume to kind of think about periods or whatever. I do remember reading, you know, like publications like Dolly and Cosmo were like important reading material for me as a teenager. Of course, I had conversations with my mum about it as well, but there are pieces of information that are helpful to get from third parties or friends or...
Yeah, it's a sort of validation that your body is not like... Because, you know, I don't know, Claire in Albury Wodonga is writing in to be like, well, this has happened to my boobs. And you're like, ah, oh, thank God. I thought it was just 12-year-old me, but...
I guess one of the ways that we might think about what a woman's voice is, one of the ways to think about that might be also to think through what a woman's voice is not, as well as a kind of to think about like an antagonistic like viewpoint. Or and both of your works have very strong male voices in them as well, and there are moments in which you feel like the male voice kind of creates an outline of the female character. I think particularly in your book, Julia, there's moments of narration from the males that kind of create an image of some of the female protagonists, and it's so directly through like kind of male gaze. And there's a sense in both of your works that women are not quite free, that there are like men lurking, or that there is like a network or an ecology of relationships at all times that all of the acts kind of rely upon. And the depictions of women are often loving. They're not all necessarily like sinister, but there are also often intensely cruel moments of that where, particularly in The Earth Does Not Get Fat, these kind of moments of incredible cruelty acted upon the women from the men in the stories. And I wonder if you might speak to some of these moments and walk through the process of writing these acts of violence in both of the works. I think I don't want to like create any spoilers because both of the books are so great, but that there are these like moments of like real intense violence committed against women in both of the books that I was like quite emotional reading, so I just kind of thought maybe we could talk about that as, and then also moments of like reclaiming that voice and like reclaiming the gaze that I just thought maybe we could talk about both of them.
That's okay. There's some quite gritty subject matter in my book, and basically the story is told mostly in the mother and the daughter's voice. And at the beginning of the a book, the mother's just dysfunctional, totally dysfunctional, emaciated, useless. And so the beginning chapters are told in the daughter's voice, and then we get access, the mother speaks towards the end, and we have some male voices. So the mother is torn by grief. She loses a son in one of the chapters and under not very horrific circumstances. And she's also prostituted effectively in her relationship by a druggy partner.
The father.
Yeah, so happy times, right? My gorgeous Matilda, one of my kids, said to me, and I said this at the book launch, she said to me, Mum, you're a silver lining person. I think it's true. I hope it's true. I hope it's also true of the book. So if I know that sounds really dark, but 99% of the reactions that I've had are about the fact that it's a love story. It's a familial, behind closed doors kind of love story. But I also think this kind of gaze that the question you're asking is interesting. And if we read something later, I'll read probably not from that. I could read from that. But also a story that I wrote more recently, which is a birth scene written in close third from the son's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think these sort of things are interesting to consider too, in the sense that to what extent do we have those conversations? To what extent do we have these conversations with other women?
Mm.
To what extent do we are men included in these conversations? And to what extent are they intimate knowledge of a women's business? And do we care, and why?